Radio Derb on the air once again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your genial host, John Derbyshire, with all the news of the hour. First, I must apologise for the technical problems that disfigured last week's broadcast from Radio Derb. Heads have rolled, pink slips have been handed out, and I can assure you that this week's broadcast will be... There is no discharge in the war, says one of Kipling's soldiers. And there's no respite in politics. I'm already reading news stories about political campaigns for 2010. 2010. It's already started. Here is one of those news stories. Quote, their majority of gubernatorial seats, now larger by one, Democrats are taking aim at key states in 2010, including California, Minnesota, and Connecticut. Republicans, who successfully re-elected four incumbents on an election night of big GOP losses elsewhere, want to win back Kansas, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, among others. End quote. Did your heart sink as you heard that, gentle listener, as mine did when I was reading it? Weren't you looking forward to a break from politics after all the obsessing of this past year and a half? Don't you sometimes get the feeling that politics is completely out of control, taking up far more space in citizens' minds than it really ought? I can see what's in it for the polls. Money, power, fame, that's not hard to understand. But what's in it for us? Beats me. Well, here, just to soothe you, is a different quote from historian Paul Johnson. He's writing about that great American president and great conservative, Warren Gamaliel Harding. Sit back, relax, take a deep breath, and be ready for a pure, fresh waft of real American air and good American horse sense. Quote from PJ. Harding won the election on his 55th birthday, which, characteristically, he celebrated by playing a round of golf. He did not believe that politics were very important, or that people should get excited about them, or allow them to penetrate too far into their everyday lives. End quote. Now that's my kind of conservative. What time does the next train leave for 1920? The accursed power which stands on privilege and goes with women and champagne and bridge broke and democracy resumed her reign, which goes with bridge and women and champagne. It's always good to remember Hilaire Belloc's lines at a time like this, when the air is filled with talk of change. There will be change, of course, and most of it for the worse, in my opinion. The next presidency is going to be a severely constrained one, though, with not much freedom for action on big things. With 13-digit deficits, boomer entitlements kicking in, and boomer income taxes drying up, and foreigners looking twice before they buy the sovereign bonds of a nation that's deep in financial doo-doo, our next president is going to have his work cut out, just staying in the saddle. Grand new entitlements programs are not going to happen. This, for example, rules out national health care. The next president's being a Democrat also rules out any real reduction in the outrageous cost of healthcare, since one of the biggest forces driving that cost is malpractice litigation, and no Democrat politician is going to tick off the Trial Lawyers Association, because the TLA is the Dems' biggest donor group and its most effective lobbyist. So, one thing you can be sure of, 4 years from now, medical costs will be eating a much bigger hole in your family budget than they are now. In fact, if you're an ordinary working person, you'll probably have joined the ranks of the uninsured, to line up at your hospital's emergency room behind all the illegal immigrants when medical disaster strikes. What else will change? Well, you can look for a full court press on political correctness and diversity. Since they won't have any money to spend, our new administration will busy themselves with stuff that doesn't cost them anything. That would include things like pumping up Title IX enforcement in colleges, demanding equal numbers of women in math and science departments, for example. Also, reimposing the fairness doctrine to shut down talk radio. And a card check bill forcing firms to recognise a union if a majority of workers want one. Then there will be hate crime laws extended to speech and internet postings. There'll be funding cut-offs for touchy areas of human genetics research. The shoring up of affirmative action programs everywhere. The extension of sanctuary cities policy to make us a sanctuary nation, with illegal immigrants officially declared a protected class. There may be a cabinet-level secretary for diversity. Don't laugh. Over in Britain, they already have a government equalities office, headed up by a cabinet-level minister for women and equalities. I am not making this up. The Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice will become a mighty force in the land, relentlessly hunting down violations of civil rights in thought, word, and deed. If you still have that Confederate flag decal on the bumper of your truck, or that bumper sticker that says, "Prensa dos para besa mi culo," you better get scraping, pal, unless you want to see the inside of a federal pen. In foreign policy, we'll be back in Warren Christopher and Cyrus Vance territory. The rule will be that we use our military as diversity enforcers, stepping in to stop gross violations of political correctness in lands less enlightened than our own. If some tribe in some African country that you never heard of starts taking machetes to some other tribe that they accuse of stealing their goats, or if some old European nation objects to having to give up part of its historic territory to alien settlers, well, you can be sure the US Marines will be there in no time to put a stop to it. After the Leathernecks have got through teaching everyone to sing Kumbaya and handed out copies of Dreams from My Father and Heather Has Two Mummies, they will climb back into their choppers, glowing with pride and satisfaction at having brought light and hope into another patch of darkness. Mission accomplished. How will our national interests be served by any of that? Good heavens, you're not still stuck in that stale old national interest paradigm, are you? Liberalism doesn't concern itself with discredited concepts like that. We love the whole world, and if we just show them our fathomless goodness and virtue, they will love us right back. Then there'll be no more war, hunger, or poverty. Don't you get it? You still don't get it? Guards, one more here for the re-education camp. Don't forget to take your toothbrush. Meanwhile, let's look back on the George W. Bush presidency. All right, I supported the guy in 2000. He was running against Al Gore, for heaven's sake. And then again in 2004, what was I supposed to do? 8 years of George W. Bush killed off my party loyalty, though. We have a decently healthy Conservative Party here in New York State, and I'm going to change my registration to it when I can face doing anything political again. What's the point of being a Republican? You elect a Republican president for 8 years, you give him a Republican Congress for 6 of those years, and what do you get? 2 pointless wars, huge new entitlements, $1 trillion deficits, 10 million illegal immigrants, Harriet Myers, Sarbanes-Oxley, no child left behind, a push to increase minority home ownership by debauching bank lending standards, and Republican Congress critters staggering around the halls of Congress under the weight of backpacks that are loaded up with lobbyist money. If conservatives, and yes, I'm going to include myself here as not having been outspoken enough, if conservatives had divorced themselves from Bush after the 2006 elections, when it was clear how much the country hated him and his stupid policies, then there might have been the chance of a better result this week. Why was Obama's talk about change so popular? Nobody wanted change in 1988, after Ronald Reagan. This year, people were fed up with incompetence, mismanagement, and corruption. That's why they went for change. Listen to a conservative friend of mine, old Washington, D.C. veteran and National Review contributor Bruce Bartlett. Quote, "These last 8 years will eventually be viewed by conservatives as the greatest wasted opportunity in history. Now eclipsing Eisenhower's first 2 years, when there was an opportunity to repeal much of the New Deal, an opportunity that Eisenhower nixed. No wonder Republicans were thrown out in 1954. Why bother electing them if they're just going to maintain the status quo?" End quote. I'm not quite ready to declare conservatism stone dead in the USA, but it's in the intensive care facility, and George W. Bush put it there. Meanwhile, our president-elect. There is a good deal to be said about the man, but I'm going to have 4 years to say it in, so let's just take it one bite-sized piece at a time. Here, mainly just to get it out of the way, I'm going to pass some remarks on the fact of his being our first black president, specifically on the role that Obama's blackness played in getting him elected. The main thing to be said here is that being black was a big help to him. For sheer starting advantages in life, there is nothing in the world better than being a smart, self-disciplined black person in America today. Every company, every department of every university, every government office from the federal to the municipal, every sports team, every labor union, every political party, all of them are desperate. They're frantic to assert their diversity credentials, and political parties especially. While Obama was running for the United States Senate in 2004, he was invited to speak at the Democratic National Convention. That's what put him on the national stage. Now, what are the chances for an undistinguished state senator from a middling state, no offence there to the good people of Illinois, who is running for the US Senate, what are the chances of him being asked to speak at a presidential convention? I don't think I'm being controversial if I say that for a black person, the chances are very good. For a white woman, much less good. And for a white man, close to zero. I'm not passing any judgment here. That's just the way things are. And not just for Democrats, either. The thing that I just said would in fact be even truer at a GOP convention. Let's face it, we are a race-obsessed nation. In the past, black Americans who were smart and capable were held back because of their race. Now, having recognized the injustice of that, we seek out capable black Americans and give them every possible assist. By acting like this, we suppose that we are asserting our nation's ideals of justice, equality, human dignity, and individual worth. This supposition is mistaken, in my opinion. Those ideals would be better asserted by treating everyone the same, without any preference. I also think there's dishonesty in our actions. By practicing this kind of favoritism, white Americans get the gift of cheap grace. That is, we get ourselves a license to avoid thinking about the really tricky race issues, like black criminality and academic achievement gaps. Here's a statistic from the Department of Justice website. Of black males in the USA, 1 in 22 was in federal or state prison at the end of June 07. For white males, it was 1 in 130. The official reason for that 6-to-1 disparity is, of course, racism. But, excuse me, we just elected a black president. And yet we're still so racist that we incarcerate black men at 6 times the rate of white men? Oh, but hey, why think about this difficult stuff? It makes our heads hurt. It makes us feel uncomfortable. And anyway, no one has a clue what to do about it, so what's the point? Voting a black guy into political office is so much easier. You just have to pull a lever. Cheap grace, you see? There is no denying that the USA has made great progress in the matter of race, as President-elect Obama illustrates. For all of the favoritism, we are closer to being a meritocracy now than we were 100 years ago. In the matter of honesty about race, though, I don't think we have much to boast about. It may even be that we have bought our progress at the cost of some honesty. I don't know. Ask your grandpa. Along with a new president-elect, we have a new first family. I'm treading on eggshells here, having once written a satirical piece about Chelsea Clinton, though the lady was 20 years old at the time and her dad was out of office. I promise you, I will have nothing to say about the Obama girls, at least not until they have reached majority and their dad's out of office. They look like very nice kids, and I wish them joy of the great adventure they're about to have. To Michelle Obama, something similar. Look, nobody runs for the office of First Lady. It's just something that happens to you, like lower back pain or being caught drunk on your front lawn by Google Street View. From what we've heard so far, and with all due allowance for it having been carefully filtered by the handlers, Michelle is going to stick to basic First Lady duties, making mild speeches on family issues, hosting state dinners, running the Easter egg roll, and all that good stuff. My guess is she'll be pretty good at it. Well, better than Hillary Clinton was, anyway. And who knows, perhaps after a couple of years in the world's best government housing, driving around in motorcades and dishing the dirt with folk like Carla Bruni, perhaps the thought will occur to Michelle that she's not any kind of victim after all. I wish her well, anyway, with just, if I may, one small note of negativity. That dress you wore to the acceptance speech, Michelle? There's a proper place for everything in this universe, and the proper place for that dress is a place called the thrift store. And finally, the first dog. Barack Obama told us that he's going to get a pooch for the kids when they move into the White House. If he won't mind me offering a recommendation, our Jack Russell Terrier has worked out just fine. Been with us 4 months now, and seems perfectly satisfied with us, once he'd won the fight over sofa privileges. So I'd say go for a Jack Russell, and don't worry too much about their bladder control issues. Heck, it's government property. And you could hold on to that dress and use it for mopping up. What else? Well, sorry to say goodbye to Sarah Palin, at least until 2012. Anyone that the intellectuals, both the right and the left intellectuals, hated as much as they hated Sarah, must have something going for them. Having just unmasked myself as an admirer of Warren Harding, I guess my taste in presidents is a bit eccentric, but I think Sarah will make a fine one, and I look forward to having the chance to vote for her again. The antimatter equivalent of Governor Palin is the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who has been let out of the sealed bunker that they've been keeping him in this past 7 months, so that he can prepare to give the blessing at the inauguration in January. He's going to need a little coaching to get rid of some of his mannerisms. I mean, it would be a little embarrassing if he reverted to type and called down the Lord's blessings on the new president of America, wouldn't it? And imagine how embarrassed the new president would be. Gosh, he never heard the Rev say anything like that before in all the 20 years he sat in Wright's pews. Still on the clerical beat, down in Atlanta, Georgia, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of that see, a man named Wilton Gregory, has urged his church, well, I guess technically he's urged the Holy Spirit, to elect a black pope next time the opportunity arises. I'm fine with it. I'd be fine with a black Archbishop of Canterbury, a black Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and a black Dalai Lama too, although I think we might run into some snags getting a black chief rabbi. America's least funny man, Al Franken, seems to have lost his election to the U.S. Senate from Minnesota, although they're going into recounts. Al is throwing temper tantrums, and I suppose anything might yet happen. Well, anything except this bilious bully making me laugh. That's never going to happen, not unless the loudmouth oaf falls into a concrete mixer. Room for just one teeny non-election item. Over in the land of my birth, the new fashion in political correctness is for municipal governments to ban the use of Latin expressions. Terms like vice versa, pro rata, and quid pro quo. Somebody has decided that Latin is discriminatory. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. But this gives me an excuse to tell a lawyer joke. Back in the days of British rule in Ireland, a circuit court was sitting in a country district over there when, at a certain point in one case, the presiding judge brushed the snuff from his surtout, leaned over his bench, and said to defendant's counsel, "Mr. O'Shaughnessy, has your client never heard the expression sic utere tuo ut alienum non lidas?" Defendant's counsel turned to the bench, pulled himself up to his full height, gripped his lapels, and replied, "My lud, in the remote fishing village in County Kilkenny, where my client lives, they speak of little else." Well, there we are, folks. We've got ourselves a new president. He's not one I would have chosen, but the way it works is we only get one president at a time. So let's reconcile ourselves to this one and do what we can to help the Republic survive for another 4 years. That's going to mean opposing everything that Obama stands for and repeatedly pointing out that everything he believes is false. That'll be our job here on the right side of the blogosphere. In the spirit of the late Bill Buckley, though, we'll be doing it in a thoughtful and charitable manner, with a dash of humour and the stirring example of the great Warren Harding always at the front of our minds. It's only politics, for crying out loud. For the sake of the country, at least, I wish our new president well.